very forks and spoons and knives.
True.
Okay, so we're holding 5 lines from the bottom of Mem Tes Amud Beis. So we, you did the thing about Gedolei Melacha Shemechavedes as Ba'alo. So yeah. Okay, continuing on. Yesterday's Gemara had talked about that Rabbi Yehuda was very poor, and that's why one time when he got a hold of Tzrodin, beets, whatever those are exactly, then it had a really good effect on him. So now the Gemara continues on that topic, showing how poor Rabbi Yehuda was. One time Rabbi Yehuda's wife went out and bought some wool. Out of glimmer the hutvi, and she made out of it a garment, a nice coat. How nice was it? Not very, really. Kadnaskis l'shuk b'michtiyabe. Glimmer means a garment. It's some kind of garment or coat or something. It wasn't really all that special, because Katnafkis Lashuka, when she would go out to the marketplace, Michsiyabe, then she would cover herself with it. But Khadnafak Rabbi Huda, hello, you have a Michsiyu Matsli. And then when Rabbi Huda went out to Davin, he would dress, he would wear it and go Davin. So you see, it wasn't, for one thing, Mefarshim say, we see from that it must, in order for it not to have been a problem of Lo Yubash Gever, that a man is not allowed to wear a woman's garment and vice versa, it must have been a pretty plain looking piece of cloth for it to be usable by both. Nevertheless, but when Rabbi Yehuda would put it on, he would make a bracha. It was to him, it was so important, even though it was a simple glima, just like a sheet, he would still make a bracha on it, blessed is Hashem, who wrapped me in a coat. To him, it was important as a coat. And actually, Marsha points out, the wooden meal actually is something that can be used of clothes. We find it in Tanakh as used of clothing for both men and women. There are men in Tanakh described as wearing a meal, like David HaMelech, Tamar and Shmuel Beis, Kichen Tobashna B'nei Samelech Me'ilim. That king's daughters would also wear a meal. So to Rabbi Yehuda, this thing was as important as a meal. This that we're saying, by the way, Nakhta Samra, that it says that Rabbi Yehuda's wife got a hold of some wool, there are actually, before, what's the point of mentioning that? There are some Mefarshim who say, actually, that it means it wasn't even regular wool that she bought. Rashi says over here that Kansa, that Yotzel Sashuk, the Kansa Tzema, she went out to the marketplace and bought some wool. There are Mefarshim who say, actually, that it means that she, like, found wool that, they, you know, they, like, you know, when sheep walk by thorny bushes or whatever, that some wool gets caught in them, that she got a hold of that, or she got a hold of some plant-like stuff that's similar to wool. The point is, like, they couldn't even afford, according to that, the point is they couldn't even afford regular wool. Nevertheless, it was so important to Rabbi Yehuda that he made a bracha on it.
Wool is still something that touches.
If wool that comes off on the thorns, though, is actually not so kosher. For example, you're not allowed to use that for tzitzis. But no, nevertheless, you're not allowed to use that for tzitzis because it's not considered a dama kosher. But nevertheless, for Rabbi Yehuda, this kind of thing was considered an important beggar, and therefore he'd make a bracha on it. Which, by the way, gets into a discussion in Shulchan Aruch, a little bit of a discussion in Shulchan Aruch. A poor person, do they make a bracha on things like new underwear or socks or whatever if it's important to them? Like we see here, Rabbi Yehuda is making a bracha on something which the average person would consider a very unimportant garment. It's actually not close to the post about that. Different opinions. You have the Mechaber versus the Ramah. The minhag nowadays is we don't, which is why we don't usually make a shechi yonu on anything other than a nice suit or kapota or something.
Well, this was kind of shechi yonu bracha.
Yeah, similar. Except that he'd say it every time he wore it. Yeah.
Every time he wore it.
Well, the pashtos. I mean, it's more like similar to Malbush Arumim. Incidentally, by the way, I don't want to get too far off topic, but there's an interesting little piece of Lubavitcher history trivia connected with this word Baruch Shaltani Me'il. In Shulchan Aruch, it talks about the question. So we know you say Leisatech Betitzis on a talus that you wrap around your body. What about, for example, a talus cotton that you don't wrap your body in? Do you say leisatech betzitzis on it, or do you say something else? Do you say almitzvah betzitzis? So the poskim can discuss pro and con. Of course, we know in the Siddur it says almitzvah betzitzis. In that connection, the Vilna Gaon brings from our Gemara over here, you see shaltani me'il, shaltani, that you should really only be saying a bracha leisatech betzitzis if you're actually wearing it as a wrapped thing, as it wrapped around your body, not because we see over here, he wrapped it around his body. The Tzemach Tzedek talks about it in Pesukei Dinim. The Tzemach Tzedek mentions that, okay, you know, it's a fair point. Yes, you should be saying Lisata Fatitis versus Salmas Fatitis, as the case may be. This particular Gemara, though, this particular expression, Shaltani Me'il, isn't really much of a proof. We find in Parshas Metzorah over there, it describes about a Metzorah, Val's in Parshas Tzri, actually, Val Sofam Yaseh, that it says he covers his mouth with the edge of his garment. So even though the Pasha is not a garment wrapping his whole body, it's just covering his head, nevertheless, described as Ituri, Shaltani Me'il. So therefore, not a raya from there that's whether what Ituri for Ituri or whatever means. Apparently, the Tzemach Tzedek wrote on it, the expression that Tzemach Tzedek used when he's quoting the Vilna Gaon on this, is he quotes what he says, and he says, Ve'ein of Shuvah, this is not an answer, because after all, you have Baal Sofam Yaseh. When the Pesukei Dinim of Tzemach Tzedek were printed in Vilna 100-odd years ago, it came out of the press, instead of saying Ve'ein of Shuvah, it said something like a much more respectful term, much more respectful expression about the Vilna Gaon, that I have a hard time, I didn't have the schus to understand the holy words, what about the Pasuk it says. So what happened? The Rebbe described it many years later in a letter. What happened was that the Vilna printers, when they saw that some ascetic writing Ve'ein of Shuvah on something of the Vilna Gaon, you know, their landsman, somebody they're very proud of, they didn't like it, so they went and changed it. But they nevertheless, it's been found in Kitzvei Yad, including in a photocopy of Ksav Yad, the original Ksav Yad of the Tzemach Tzedek, the actual original words Ve'ein of Shuvah. So that the printer has actually changed it. And you still have, of course, there are conspiracy theorists who claim the other way around, that the original is what was printed, and whatever. But yeah, so a little piece of trivia over here connected with it. Okay, continuing with the Gemara, Zimna Chod, Gazin of Shimon Gamliel Tani. So one time of Shimon Gamliel declared a Tainis, Rabbi Huda, Loi also by Tainis, and Rabbi Huda didn't show up for the Tainis. Everybody was supposed to gather together in the Nazi's house to daven together, and Rabbi Huda didn't come. Amrim Loi, so they told Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Loi is like Yisuya, he doesn't have anything to wear. Either this was before Rabbi Huda's wife had made this coat that we just talked about, or this was one of the times when she's wearing it to go out shopping, so therefore he didn't have it. Shadalai glima. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel sent a coat for Rabbi Huda to wear. V'lai kabel, but he didn't want to accept it. Dali tzifsa. He picked up the mat that he was lying on. V'amalei l'shlucha, and he said to the shliach, to the person Rabbi Shimon Gamliel had sent to bring him, Chazi mai ika. Look what there is over here. There were gold coins under it. There was a nest happened. Most of the Mepharshim say that it was a nest, that there hadn't been any gold coins there before, but all of a sudden, gold coins were created there. Under the mat that he was sitting on. People used to sit on mats in those days. They didn't sit on chairs.
He sent them a call, he didn't accept.
Okay. He didn't accept, and he's showing them, look, I have plenty of gold coins. If I want enough, I have enough from Mice and Nissim to be able to buy a coat. Mule, Nichol, for offering it to me, but you should know the same principle why I could have these coins available, but I want to have enough from them because they might be missing. By the same token, in general, I don't want to have hana from the world, and therefore I'm going to turn down the coat.
Having gold coins under your mat is having big hana from this world.
It's not because they he doesn't need them. If he's not using them, then you don't have enough from them.
The fact of having them is already hana.
Nah, not really.
Oh no, if you had gold coins under your mat,
if you know you can't, if you're not going to be using them, come on.
Well, if you ate them dry.
You ate and drank, fine, you have to eat and drink, you have no choice. But the same way as Rabbi Huda Nasi in the next generation is said on himself, even though he was very rich, as we're going to learn later on, and tomorrow, he was very, very rich, nevertheless, he said at the end of his life that he never had hana from the world. It all depends on how you look at it. We'll learn later on when we get to at the end of the daf, or more likely tomorrow, we'll talk about the discussion between Rebbe and Bakapara on that subject. Wait.
Will they take that?
Relax, wait. Okay. Another story, speaking of Chachamim who were very poor at one time, Rabbi Akiva Iskachet Lebrate de Bard Kalba Savua. Rabbi Akiva, the daughter of Kalba Savua, was engaged to him. We know the famous story. Here we had an exodus. Here it is again with some variations. This was one of the rich people in the time of the Beis Mikdash. Yeah. Shama bar Kalba Savua, Adra Hana Mikol Nichseh, bar Kalba Savua heard it and made a nether that she's not allowed to have Hana from any of his property because we don't know the story. Rabbi Akiva was Nama Aretz, and then Kalba Savua felt that it was wrong of her to do that. Still, she went and married him in the winter, which the point of mentioning that it was in the winter, Marsha says, is even
that
she's marrying an Amoris like that. Yeah, at the time, Rabbi Akiva was an Amoris, yeah.
She saw
in him a potential, yeah, that he can become, yeah. But Kabbalah Sevor didn't see that. So she got married to him in the winter. Marsha points out the point of saying that it was in the winter is that even though it was cold, as Gemara is going to say in a second, they had to sleep in the straw, still she went ahead with it. There are Gersaites that instead of the Sitra, the word is the Sitra in secret, that she got married to him. Anyway, Havagonu Beitivna, and now they're sleeping in the among the straw because they didn't have anything more to sleep in. Have a commandment like Tivna min Mazya. So Rabbi Akiva would have to pick out the straw from her hair. Or Marsha has a different girsa that he was picking out the straw from his own hair. The straw would get stuck in their hair, and they'd have to pick it out. Omallah, so Rabbi Akiva says to his wife, to Rachel, Ihavoyli, if I would have the money, Ramina Loch Yerushalayim the Dava, I would put on you a Yerushalayim of gold. It's a tachshis. We learned about it in Shabbos, either a necklace or a tiara or whatever that had a picture of Yerushalayim on it. It's made out of gold and jewels. We learned about it in Shabbos, and we mentioned it briefly a few weeks ago, I think, in some other connection, I don't remember what. And sure enough, later on, as Gemara says further on in the Yomud, eventually he did become rich and he did get her one. Actually, the Yerushalmi mentions an interesting detail about that Rabbi Gamliel, who was a Nasi at that time, his wife, one time asked him, knew, how come I don't get a Yerushalayim Shel Zahav like he did, like she did, and Rabbi Gamliel told her, and Rabbi Gamliel told his wife, look, you know, did you do for me what Rachel did for Rabbi Akiva, selling, even cutting off her own hair and selling it for wigs and sleeping in the straw or whatever, so he could go learn Torah. She had a lot more Mesidus Nefesh than you did. That's the Yerushalmi mentions that, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. Also, idmi loin kanosha. Now, in order to make them feel a little better about the situation, they're having to sleep in the straw there. So Elio came and pretended to be a regular person, and he came knocking at the door. Amar hovoli porta de tivna. He says to them, please give me a little bit of straw. Di yaldas itzi, because my wife has given birth. Bless the midam, laguna, I don't have anything for her to lay on. Rabbi Akiva says to his wife, "Call the governor after the tivna. Look how much better we are off than this guy. We at least have straw to sleep on. He doesn't even have that much."
In front of Eliyahu.
Yeah, he didn't know it was Eliyahu HaNavi.
No, but Eliyahu knew.
But that was the point, that the Eved Shah sent Eliyahu HaNavi to help make them feel better about their situation. No, this is okay. Yeah, maybe afterwards Rabbi Akiva says to his wife, whatever. Yeah. I saw, by the way, a verse, speaking of the Vilna Gaon from a minute ago, I saw a verse where he explains a deeper idea in this, that the straw, he also uses the gear, so that the straw was stuck in Rabbi Akiva's hair, and Rachel would have to pick it out. It represents, the straw represents like the ideas, the worldly knowledge that Rabbi Akiva had in his head, which like has to be picked out in order for him to be able to go and focus on learning Torah. But the straw represents a certain kind of das, and therefore this poor person comes and says, you know, you at least have some kind of knowledge of something Rabbi Akiva was a shepherd beforehand. I didn't even have that. And then Rabbi Akiva and Rachel realize that, you know what, even Taka were poor, and Taka, my head is full of shtus, full of straw that has to be pulled out in order to make room for Torah. At least I'm better off than, at least to start with, though, I'm better off than somebody who doesn't even have that. Amrale, his wife tells him, Zil Havi Beirav, go be in the yeshiva. Havi actually has a double meaning. It can mean be there. It can also be fine throughout the Gemara. Havayas Tabai Beirav, Havi Barab there, or whatever. It means like to think deeply into something. So it can mean also, you know, go to the Bes Medrash and start practicing this and learning there. Ozel Tautisrishnin, Kamedu Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Yeshua. So he went for 12 years and learned by Rabbi Lezer and Rabbi Yeshua. Lemishlam Tarkis Veshinin, when 12 years were up, Ka'asul Beise, he comes back home. Shomam in Achore Beise, he hears from behind his house, he hears somebody talking with his wife. Nekamal Echad Rosha Ledevesu, a certain Rosha says to his wife, Shapir Ovid Lachavuch, your father did good by disinheriting you. For marrying such a guy. Number one, this guy you married is not like you at all. The Ran says it means he's not from an important family like you. Kabbalah Sevor was from a family with Yichus, or Akiva was a Ben Perin. Marsha points out that also the guy meant your father is rich. This guy is a poor guy. He's a nothing, yeah. And also, he's left you as like a living widow all these years. You're almost like an aguna sitting over here 12 years without your husband. Yes. We know it actually based on Obastur of Nassim, Rabbi Akiva first of all before he married Rachel, it seems Rabbi Akiva had previously been married, because in Obastur of Nassim, where it also tells the whole story of how Rabbi Akiva became a Talmid Chacham, it mentions that to start with, he and his son went together to Cheder to learn Aleph Beis. So it seems that he had a first wife who died or divorced, whatever, and he had a son from her. Yesh Oimrim, that son is Rabbi Yeshua ben Karach, who is mentioned in many places in Shas. And then we know that Rabbi Akiva and Rachel had a couple of children. They're mentioned in various places in Shas. So it's in Midrashim or whatever, it's one or more of them may have been born before he left to go to Yeshiva. We really don't know.
Why wouldn't she go with him to Yeshiva?
It was a normal thing. We learned in Ksubas that it was a more normal thing for Talmid Chachamim to go away for many years so they could learn Torah without distractions. We don't know yet if at the time he did. Yeah. I don't know. So that's the work then. So one idea of it is if he was born before Rabbi Akiva ever became the famous Rabbi Akiva, when he was just Sam, a bald shepherd, then he's going to be called Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, like the son of the bald guy. Okay. Rachel says to the guy, you know what, if my husband would listen to me, then he would go back to the yeshiva and be there for another 12 years. I would be happy for him to do that. Omar, so Rabbi Akiva thought to himself, good, if she gave me Rishusa, then I'll turn around and go right back to the yeshiva. Incidentally, by the way, there's a few slight differences between the story as we have it here and the story as we had it in Exodus a couple of months ago. One interesting difference in detail is that there it said that the person who came and told Rachel Hayitachan, your husband is away for so many years, was Habu Sava, an old man. Here it calls him Habu Rasha. So what's the difference? And the truth is, actually, in many places, there are mepharshim. I think Tosfos mentions in one or two places that a possibility that whenever the Gemara says Ahu Sava, it actually means Eliyahu Anavi. So what is it? Is it Eliyahu Anavi or Rasha? So Ben Yehoyada says actually it was both. First, the Ahu Sava, the old man, possibly Eliyahu Anavi, came and told her, not in a mocking way like this, what a lousy husband you have. But in a more in a respectful way, like, you know, how are you managing over here all these years, basically, without your husband around? And she says, you know what, I'd be happy for him to go live in another 12 years. Then the Rosha, having overheard that, comes and starts telling her the same thing, but in a mocking way. Look what a lousy husband you have that he abandoned you all these years. And she gives him the same answer. So now Rabbi Akiva, having overheard all of that, that she gave the same answer to two different people, you know what, obviously this is what she wants. And he turned around and went back.
He had a seat.
Yeah.
He didn't even tell her that he came back?
Apparently not. Actually, there's an interesting thing. In the Art Scroll Gemara, they bring a word from Chaim Shmulevitz, one of the Balei Amusar, that he says it's like you can't compare two halves to one whole. So therefore, if he were to have, he lived 12 years, and then he came back home and had a CD or whatever, and went back for another 12 years, yeah, it would be a great thing. But it's not the same effect as 24 uninterrupted years.
It's so curious.
Yeah.
Wait.
We have over here also. Hodo Ozel, then when he came back after 24 years, have a Tartisration Neachrai in Isa. He was there for 12 more years. Also, Zugi Talmidi. He came back with 24,000 pairs of Talmidim. Actually, it's not so simple. I mean, here it says 24,000 pairs, which would be 48,000 Talmidim. In Ksubas there, it said the expression just 24,000. And in Yevamos, also where it talked about Rabbi Akiva's students dying during Sfiras HaOmer, it said 12,000 pairs. So it could be that the Matikim over here could be the copyists or the printers by mistake put together two different versions. Whatever it is,
the first time he came
with 12,000 students, and then he came back to 24,000. So everybody came out to greet him. But Afi Komas Lamei, she also got up to go and greet him. Omalahu Rashiya, a certain Rasha says to her, maybe the same Rasha from before, we don't know. Va'aflahecha, where do you think you're going? You don't even have proper clothes to dress to greet him in. Omrulay, she said to him, don't worry, Yadeh Tzadik Nefesh Behemta. Tzadik knows the soul of his behemoth, meaning he knows how much I went through over the years with him. Why she uses the word behemoth, Maharsha explains, because he started out as a shepherd. It's like he was a shepherd. He took good care of his animals. How much more so he knows to take good care of me. He's not going to look at my chitzonius. He knows to look deeper than that. Also, please, chazuyaleh, so she came to appear to him. Kamad from the Rabbanan, and the Rabbanan are pushing her away. There's a big crowd over there. Amr Lahay, and he says to them, Hanichulah, leave her alone, Shaliva Shalachem Shalahu. Everything that I have and everything that you have all comes from her. Shama Bar Kalba Savur, so Bar Kalba Savur heard that there's that's a big tzaddik, a Tamachacham in town, and that it's his son-in-law, Rabbi Akiva. Also, the Itchel of Nidre, he went to be Mapu Neder, the Ishtiri, and it was mutter for him. And it was mutter. Which before Shem discussed a little bit the question, could Rabbi Akiva be mocked with a neder? On the face of it, Rabbi Akiva is a neder, a dover. So in Ksubas it actually says the more details. In Ksubas it gives more details that Kalba Savua, here is a great Talmud Chacham in town. He doesn't realize it's Rabbi Akiva. He doesn't realize it's the same Akiva that his daughter married. So he goes to him and says, you know, I feel bad, I want to be mocked to my neder, but I need a Pesach. So the Rabbi Akiva tells him, you know, would you have made the neder if you had known that he was going to come in time of Chacham? Yeah, even if he had known one halacha or one something, I would never have made such a neder. And Rabbi Akiva tells him, in that case, then I can be mocked to your neder, that's me. So what happens? How can Rabbi Akiva be mocked to the neder? If he's a negev adover, then he's going to be benefiting from it. So the Rabbi Taz, for example, brings, yeah, it doesn't mean he himself was mocked to the neder. It means he found him the Pesach, and then you can get together a Beis Din. Rabbi Akiva himself actually can be one of the members of that panel, to be, but he can't do it himself because he'd be a negev adover, but you can have, once a Pesach is found, then yes, he could be a member of the Beis Din to be mocked to it. Either other Mepharshim would say that it just means Vahatila, you have other people to be master it, or there's another possibility, it's Pesach versus Karata, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks. Anyway, they also discussed the question, by the way, about the whole question of Nolad. We learned briefly earlier in the Masechta, we're going to learn much more in a couple of weeks, that you can't use Nolad as a Pesach, something completely unexpected that happened, that granted you wouldn't have made the neder if you knew this was the case, but it has to be something that can be expectable. So how is that possible? So the Ran talks on Amad Beis, very simple. Given that Rachel only married Rabbi Akiva on the condition that he's going to go and learn in the first place, so therefore, yeah, it was an obvious thing when they got married. It was an expectable thing that he's going to end up learning one halacha, and Kalba Sabor said, if I'd known that he was going to learn one halacha, I would never have made a neder. So the ritual talks about that in that sense, therefore it was more of a neder betos, because he didn't realize already that Rabbi Akiva is starting to learn. Yeah. Anyway. So, the Gemara says,
at least 24,000 Talmidim are the ones
who... These are the ones who died during Sefira, yeah.
Nothing was said.
So, there was, afterwards, Rabbi Akiva got 5 new Talmidim. Yeah. What? Only 5, but Behem Hamid or Torah, Baruch Hashem, we learned in Yavamas. They're the ones who set back up Torah in that time. But this is, by the way, why. When you consider how much we get from Rabbi Akiva just through those 5 Talmidim, imagine what we would have gotten through 24,000. This is why Adai Yemazer, we still keep the Minu, the Menahazim of Sfira, because, you know, we have to realize what we lost. The Gemara continues, Min Shis Mili Yatar Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva actually became rich from 6 different sources. And Marsha points out the reason why the Gemara needs to point that out is we shouldn't think if Rabbi Akiva had all those thousands of Talmidim, he must have charged them for teaching them, and he became rich that way. No, we learned a couple of weeks ago, you're not allowed to charge for learning, for teaching Torah. Therefore, we have to be told that he became rich from various other sources. This, by the way, that we say that he became rich from 6 sources, it's brought in a few places in Sefer Kabbalah that everybody brings it in Likud HaSichos. There's a deeper idea behind it, that Rabbi Akiva has a certain association with Yaakov Avinu. The name Akiva actually has the letter that is pretty much related to the name Yaakov. In one or two places in Tanakh, the Eibishter is called Avir Yaakov, the powerful one of Yaakov, and it's brought in Kisvei Arizal, but that's the same letter is rearranged as Rabbi Akiva. Yaakov is associated with the letter Vav, because the letter Vav is the letter of Tiferet, and the Briah Hatich and Briah, and therefore Rabbi Akiva also has to be associated with 6, and therefore he had 6 different sources of wealth. Marsha also brings the idea that it was a schar for the fact that he learned Shisha Sidre Mishnah. Number one is that Kalba Savur gave him some of his wealth. We learned in Kesubas over there that he gave him half of his wealth. Number two, min ila de sfinta, from the deer on the ship. What is that? The chol sfinta abdulay min ena. Every ship that they made in those days, they would make a picture of a deer out of wood that they would go like on the front of the ship. The Ran says they would use it. It was for a good simon. Like a deer runs fast. It was like a magical thing. Like the ship should go just as fast as the deer. The other Rishonim have other Mefarshim have the gears over here. The Rosh has a gears over here instead of Eina, mean honor, something like something from the sheep family, so like a ram or something. Maybe instead of Ela, a deer, it's really supposed to be Ayala, a ram, whatever. Anyway, Zimna Chada and Shiyua al Kefiyam. One time the sailors left that. Image of a ram or deer or whatever it is on the shore. Also, who Ashkechei and Rabbi Akiva came by and found it, and it turned out to be full of money. The point is that the Ram says they wouldn't just make it as a good luck thing for the ship. They would also put the ship's treasury in it. So when it was lost on there on the seashore, then Rabbi Akiva found that it's full of gold coins.
Floated.
I don't know. Here it says, okay, maybe. I mean, it says over here on Shiyur, they forgot it by the seashore. Actually, Shittim Kuvetis brings an interesting variation of it, that what happened was, when Rabbi Akiva found it, he started announcing it's a lost thing. You got to announce Hashavas Aveda. It turned out the sailors came and claimed it, but Rabbi Akiva was ready to return it to them. They were so impressed by his honesty that they told him, you know what, you keep it. You need it more than we do. Okay, number three, Umin Gavza. Number three from the Gavza. So what's a Gavza? The Ram says it means a treasure chest. There's various other Mefarshim. The Rosh says that rather it means a big block of wood. The Zimna Chada Yarev Arba Zuzil Espunai. One time Rabbi Akiva gave four Zuzim to some sailors. Amalu Aisi Limidam. He tells them, use these four Zuzim to bring me back something worthwhile. All they found was this Gavza on the seashore. Again, either a box or a big block of wood. I see you, Alay, they brought it to him. Let the Rebbe do with it whatever he wants. It turned out that it was full of gold coins. The Zimna Chada Tavas Sfinta, because how did it happen? How does it come to be full of gold coins? One time a ship sank. Here's where the ship sank. One time a ship sank. Kula Iskava Machis Bahu Gavza. All the ship's treasure was in that box or block of wood. The Ishtakaf Bahu Zimna Dimin Disrukisa. And it turned out at that time. Now, where was the ship from? It was an Arab ship. Srukisa means Arab. Because the idea is like they so especially according to the Rosh's understanding that Gavza means a block of wood is they didn't put it in a regular chest because they were afraid people would steal it. They put it in something that looked like a big block of wood, so nobody would realize that. So therefore, these sailors also didn't realize when they brought it to Rabbi Akiva. In fact, Marshall says what happened was they brought on the block of wood. They said, look, you know, you can always use it as an anvil or something. You can use it to chop things on. And as he's chopping things on it, he finds it's full of gold coins. Number four, Umin Matrunisa. Number four, Rabbi Akiva got money from a Roman matron, a Roman noblewoman. What happened? So all the Mefarshim here tell more or less the same story with slight variation. That one time Rabbi Akiva needed to borrow money, so he goes to a rich Roman woman. She says, sure, I'll lend it to you, but I want a guarantor. So who should be the guarantor? I want your God and the sea to be the guarantors for this loan. Okay, fine. Comes the day of payment. Rabbi Akiva is supposed to go pay her, but he was sick. He couldn't make it. So she's standing there by the seashore, you know, knew where's the money. I'm sure Rabbi Akiva is reliable, but okay, if he can't come through, then the guarantors have to come through. The Ebishta, all of a sudden, back in Rome, meanwhile, a princess over there all of a sudden has the Ebishta puts a crazy idea in her head. She takes a chest of gold or diamonds or whatever it is out of her father's treasury and throws it into the sea. It goes from wave to wave, it travels from wave to wave, and lands on the shore right in front of her. She opens it up, and it's even more money than Rabbi Akiva had borrowed from her in the first place. So then when he gets better and comes to repay her the loan, she says, your guarantors already came through. The Abish, your God on the sea already came through. So you know what? You keep the money that you borrowed. You know, you can use it for your Tamidim. So set up the fourth source. Yeah. Number five, Umin Ishtesh of Turnus Rufus. Number five, Rabbi Akiva got money from the wife of Turnus Rufus. The Tunis Rufus, we find throughout the, we find in many different Gemaras and Midrashim and whatever, that he was always Rabbi Akiva's nemesis. There's a number of places where you have, they would argue on various things, various topics in Psukim and in Jewish life and whatever. Famous one, for example, in Bava Basra, where Tunis Rufus argues that Hashem must hate poor people, Hayitacha, otherwise why would they be poor? So then why is there, so if the Abish to hate them, then shouldn't you be in trouble for supporting? He was a Roman, yeah, he was a Roman governor of Eretz Yisrael. For example, Tunis Rufus argues, look, you know, obviously your God hates poor people, so Abba, you should be in trouble for supporting them. And so, you know, if a king throws somebody in jail, you'd be mad if somebody goes and helps the guy. So Hayitacha, and you're supporting the poor people and you say Hashem likes it. And Rabbi Akiva explains to him that, no, imagine, don't think of it as a slave being thrown into jail, think of it as a prince being thrown into jail. You don't think the king would be happy if behind his back somebody goes and helps the prince, B'nei B'chori Yisrael, the Jewish people, B'nei Matam, Hashem Elokeichem. And this is one example. There's a lot of places in Shas and Midrashim where there's arguments between them. Anyway, what happened was, so again, all the Mephoshim here tell pretty much the same story, that after a while, Tunis Rufus got very frustrated with this. Rabbi Akiva is always besting him in these arguments. So he decided, you know what? In that case, then I'll do like Bilam's plan from the end of Parashas Balak. Get him into trouble with Znus, and then Hashem will stop helping him. So he sends his wife to try and seduce Rabbi Akiva. He sends his wife to try and seduce Rabbi Akiva. Rashi here actually adds the detail that all of them say that she dressed up. Rashi adds the detail that she came and uncovered her leg in front of him. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva spat on the floor and cried and laughed. She asked him, what's all that about? He says, I spit on the floor because think of it, all this beauty of yours, where did it come? It comes from a smelly drop of sperm. What about I'm crying because Hai Shufer, the Bali Bahara, Hai Tochen, one day this beauty is going to be rotting away in the ground. Why did I laugh? That I don't want to tell you. Why, Taka? Because what happened was that she realized, you know, she didn't get anywhere with him, actually. She says to him, you know what? Is there any possibility of a person doing tshuva? And he says to her, yeah. She wound up after some she was a goita, but still. So Rashi says after her husband died, other Mephoshim say even while her husband was alive, whatever, she became a geyoris, and she wound up marrying Rabbi Akiva, apparently after Rachel passed away. And therefore, so she had money, but she came from money, so she brought a lot of that into the marriage, and that's the fifth source of Rabbi Akiva's wealth.
So that's after Rachel,
the Pashtas is after Rachel passed away, yeah. I mean, I can't imagine.
What did she
want? I don't understand.
What age Rabbi Akiva?
Oh, I don't know. He lived to 120. He lived to 120. How old he was at the time of the story, basically.
So
number six, I'm in Ketiyah Bar Shalom. Number six, Rabbi Akiva got money from Ketiyah, but come, sit a little closer. We have Gemara's over here. Number six, Rabbi Akiva got money from... Oh, so Tunis Rufus asked his wife to go and seduce Rabbi Akiva, realizing he's not getting anywhere with trying to beat Rabbi Akiva in argument, so he figured he's going to try to beat him by getting him to involved in Averis. Yeah. So she came to him, and then Rabbi Akiva spit on the floor and laughed. Oh, so the laughing was he realized Baruch HaKadosh that she's going to wind up marrying him, that he or she's coming to try and trap him into an issue, and she's going to wind up being with him back. That was what he was laughing. Tunis Rufus was a Roman governor of Eretz Yisrael. Rashi just says that Begil Sashayka connected, that she uncovered her leg in front of him, like trying . Okay, and number six, I'm in Ketiyah Bar Shalom. Ketiyah Bar Shalom is a story in Avodah Zarah. The gist of it is that one of the Roman emperors starts consulting with his advisors, the Senate, whatever. What should we do about the Jews? Should we destroy them from the empire? One of the senators or whatever speaks up and says, you know, you can't. First of all, there are Jews all over the world, including outside the Roman Empire, so you're never going to be able to kill them all anyway. Number two, if you kill all the Jews in the empire, the empire is going to suffer. It's going to be like a cut-off kingdom, like not an unworthy kingdom anymore. And the emperor...
Who said that? The senator, wait.
So the emperor says, you know what, okay, you got a point, fine, I won't do it, but you're in trouble, you're in trouble for contradicting the emperor and then beating him in a debate. Your punishment is that you're going to be buried alive. as the guy is being taken to be executed, to be buried alive, he first of all, a woman who was there, a Roman matron, says, you know, a shod, like, you know, the ship is going and hasn't paid the toll. In other words, to say, like, you should be going into Gan Eden for having helped save the Jewish people, but you don't have a Bris Milah. So he right away made him a Bris Milah on himself right then and there, and he said, yeah, okay, I've paid the toll. Then, as he's dying, as he's being buried over there, he says that's why he's called Ketia Bar Shalom, Ketia Meloshin Ketua, that he cut off his Arla, Bar Shalom, because he went into Gan Eden and had Shalom over there. So as he's dying, he calls out, all my nechassim should go to Rabbi Akiva B'chaverov. So half of it went to Rabbi Akiva, and half of it went to the other chachamim of that time, and that's the sixth source of Rabbi Akiva's wealth. A similar story about the son of an Amora who got money like that in an unexpected way from some sailors. Rav Gamda Yoiv Dalab Zuzi Lasfunoi Lasuri Bahimidam. Rav Gamda one time gave 4 Zuzim to sailors to go bring them something with it. Loy Ashkahu, they couldn't find anything worthwhile to spend the 4 Zuzim on. And eventually Aisur lay behind Koifa. Eventually they bought for him a monkey with the 4 Zuz.
Monkey.
Monkey, a pet monkey. Ishtamit, the monkey got squirmed out of their arms. Al Kharsa, it went into a hole. Chafru Basre, the sailors started digging into the hole to get the monkey back. Ashkechud, the Revi'a, Magulaisa, they found the monkey sitting there on a whole bunch of jewels. I seen him like Kulin, and they brought him all the jewels. They brought Rav Gamda all the jewels because your monkey is the one who found him. And by the way, Meforshim point out, and in particular, the Ran points out over here this, that they gave him the jewels in Midas Chassidus. Some Meforshim discussed, you know, legally were they obligated to give him anything? The monkey, he hadn't really made a kinyan on the monkey yet, or maybe at most they were responsible to give him half of it, because you could argue it was his monkey, but still not the whole thing. The Marsha points out, the Gemara mentions at the end of Kedushin, Hasaponin Ruben Chassidim, that most sailors are Chassidim, because they're constantly exposed to danger on the sea, so therefore they're very religious, very frum, and therefore we see that from this story over here, that these sailors went Lefnim Meshurat Hadin and gave all the jewels to Rav Gamda. No, the monkey itself can't make a kinyan. The point is, if Rav Gamda himself had made a kinyan on the monkey, then yes, if his monkey finds jewels, then yeah, he's entitled to some of them. But he hadn't even made a kinyan on it yet. It jumped out of their arms before he even got a chance to, yeah. Okay. Rav Gamda, yeah. Since we talked about before going back to Talmud Chachamim who were poor and maybe didn't look so attractive, we had yesterday about Rabbi Yehuda that his face was unusually bright. So now a similar story. We have this in Tainus as well. Amrulei Bas Keser Rabbi Shob ben Chananya, the daughter of the Keser says to Rabbi Shob ben Chananya, who we also find in many Gemaras and many Midrashim that he used to regularly have debates of all kinds with the emperors of there in matters of Torah and Milad Alma and whatever. She says to him, Torah before Arba Kli Mechor, look at this, a beautiful Torah in such an ugly vessel. Because Rabbi Yeshua did not look so handsome. One thing is, for he himself may have not have been a handsome person. He also, we learn in Brachas that he worked for a living. He worked with charcoal, so he may have been black and dirty from that. Amrullah, so Rabbi Yeshua answers her, Limdi b'vesavuch. Listen, look, learn from how they do it in your father's house. What kind of bottles do they put wine in? Amrullah b'moni de pachra. She says we put it in earthenware containers. Amrullah, he says to her, kulam of pachra ba'asim b'moni de pachra. So what is it? Everybody else uses earthenware clay containers. You should also. You're special people. You're the emperor's family. Asur nachisim b'moni de kasva v'dava. You should be putting it in gold and silver utensils. Asur nachisim b'moni de kasva v'dava. So sure enough, they went and put the wine into gold and silver vessels. So sure enough, she went and put the wine into gold and silver utensils. But sorry, and it went bad because metal reacts with wine, or then we're doesn't. Amallah, so he says in Tainus it has a little more of the detail that afterwards the emperor is upset how you talk and all my wine spoiled. What made you do such a thing? She says, Rabbi Yeshua told me. The emperor calls in Rabbi Yeshua, and the rest continues like it says over here. Amallah, so Rabbi Yeshua tells her, Aphrodite came. So it is also with the Torah. Torah doesn't lack in people who are beautiful like gold and silver utensils. It lacks more in people who are plain like earthenware. Okay? She asks, or the emperor asks, whatever, fine, don't you have people who are handsome and also who know Torah? Amalah, so he says to her, yes, but you know what? If they were ugly, they would know even more. Or actually, the word sonu doesn't literally mean ugly, it literally means hateful. So Tosfos and Tainus, by the other version of the story over there, says, doesn't necessarily mean that they're ugly. You have people who have a real hadras panim and are great tamar chacham. It means if they would hate their beauty, if they're like, not hate, but like, don't, you know, it's not important to them, the fact whether they're beautiful or handsome or what have you. If they didn't focus on their looks, then they would be much greater tamar chacham. Another story, also about a great Tamar Chacham who was not so physically attractive. There was a woman who came to a Din Torah, who came from Nahauda to a Din Torah in front of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda lived in Pompadissa. This woman came from Nahauda. And she was judged, the guilty party in the Din Torah. Amrulay, so she says to him, Shmur Rabba Chachit Anan. Would your Rebbe Shmuel have been done me like this? The way you, I don't think you judged me fairly. I think Shmuel did a much, or Marsha says slightly differently that she's saying as a fact. She's saying, not Marsha, Ben Yehuda says that she's saying as a fact. Yeah, you know what? Shmuel judged the same kind of thing many years ago. He judged the same way. Amalah, so Rabbi Yehuda says to her, Yadaple, so you know him. Which Ben Yehuda says, the point is he's asking, if you already had such a Din Torah in front of Shmuel all those years ago, what are you coming to me as Talmud now? Amr Lay, she says, yes, and I can describe him. In Gutza, he was short, Verava Kreise, and he had a big stomach. Ucham, he was dark, Verava Shine, and he had big teeth. Amallah, so Rabbi Yehuda says to her, Levazuya Kasis. So what, you just came here to make fun of him? Like, yeah, she could, you know, the Mordechai actually points out in the Ma'arit quotes that we see from this, that even a person could use the excuse. She could have said, you know, look, I'm just trying to describe him. But the way she described him in such a bizarre dick way, Rabbi Yehuda realized she's doing it just to make fun of him. Kehaviah, he eats a b'shamta. Such a woman should be in shamta in Cherem. Paco Mesa, she exploded and died from the force of the Cherem. So we see that, but still, you don't have any business describing them in such unflattering terms like that. She could have found a more respectful way to say it. Okay. The Mishnah had gotten into the various possibilities when a person makes a neder not to eat cooked things. The Mishnah talks about three or four different possibilities where a person says tavshil versus mevushel versus hayyur and lekzera, etc. So that was what brought us into this whole side thing, because it talked about eating, it talked about cooked pumpkins and then various other kinds of cooked things, cooked daisa, yeah. So now, getting back to the Mishnah, had said mutbebeitzer to a mitzvah, that a person who says that I'm making an iser on myself to eat a tavshil is allowed to. Where we said that tavshil means anything that's eaten with bread is allowed to eat a beitzer to a mitzvah, my beitzer to a mitzvah. On Mashmul, you should know something. It's such a rare thing. After the Ovid lay shavi alpha dinri, a slave who knows how to prepare a beitzer to a mitzvah properly is worth 1,000 zuz. Or other Mepharshim say, what he's saying is a slightly different girsa, that they're saying such an egg prepared properly is worth 1,000 zuz. What is it? Uma'ayla alpha zimni b'maya chamimi v'alpha zimni b'maya feriri. You take the egg, you boil it, and then you put it 1,000 times in hot water and 1,000 times in cold water, adimit zutra, until it becomes very small. Or the heat and cold, and heat and cold shrinks it till it becomes very small. So then now a person is able to swallow it. The im is keva, and if now, if the person has any kind of stomach illness, sorry chala, then some of the stuff, some of the germs, or some of the stomach mucus, or whatever, will stick to this egg. And then when it comes out the other end, because it's been cooked for so much, it's not really digestible, so it comes out pretty much whole with whatever was in the stomach stuck to it. So then the doctor knows what to prescribe the person. So that's the value of a beta to a mitzvah. Sort of, yeah, actually, that's a good point, yeah. So therefore, now beis tzurmita is not eaten with bread. So therefore, that's what the Mishnah is saying, that a person who makes a neder not to eat a tavshil is allowed to eat a beis tzurmita. The Rambam, by the way, has a different definition of beis tzurmita in Pirush HaMishnayos. He says that basically a beis tzurmita is a soft boiled egg. It's boiled in such a way that it remains soft and it's good for sick people. The Pirush explained that in the Rambam's time, nobody used a beis tzurmita of the kind the Gemara describes anymore, but a sick person would eat a soft boiled egg. So therefore, that's what the Rambam describes as. Yoda asked if my son mitbile, so doctor knows what to prescribe him, or my mitzi and how to heal him. Shmuel have a bodich nafshi b'kulcha. Shmuel, when he was sick, would check himself out with a kulcha. Now, what is a kulcha? The Ran says, I don't know what it is. It can't be a beis tzurmita, because we just said Shmuel himself was saying that it's a rare thing. You need, it's only somebody worth thousands of zuz would know how to prepare such a thing. So Shmuel himself, the Ran says, didn't know how to prepare it. So therefore, a kulcha, according to the Ran, would have to be something else. But he says, I don't know what it is. On the other hand, the Rosh says it does mean a beis tzurmita. Kulcha is another word for it. And then the Aruch talks about the idea that kulcha means a stalk, like a celery or something. Like he would swallow it whole, and then again, the idea is when it came out the other end, he didn't know what to do with it. I saw also somebody wanted to explain that a kulcha is basically like a tube that he'd stick down his throat to. Again, similar, it would be, I guess, similar, not really a colonoscopy, because at the other end, more like a gastroscopy or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. But it caused them so much pain. And the people of his household, meaning his wife and the other women in his household, would untie their braids and like pull up their hair out of tsar, out of the tsar that he's going through with his, whether the beis tzurmita or the stalk of celery or the tube, whatever it is, that it caused them so much pain that they would be or maybe even he'd faint from it, so that they'd be tearing out their hair like what's going to happen with him. Rashi says over here, from eating this beis tzurmita or whatever it is, he would be so weak that they'd start tearing out his hair like yeah. Another topic, tznanhos, and we learn more of a topic about things that are about medicinal things, kind of. Tznanhos, and starting out, we learn in a Mishnah in Maestris as follows. Now, the Torah tells us in Parshas Kitseitse that when a person is working on a farm or whatever, a person is working with work that involves food, you have to let him eat some of it. There's actually the details of it on Matzia. There's different details, what kind of food, what kind of work, whatever. But the Pasuk says when you come into your neighbor's vineyard, then you can eat grapes as much as you want. The Gemara explains over there doesn't just mean you walk into your neighbor's vineyard, otherwise everybody would eat up everybody else's grapes. It means a worker who's there to work on the vineyard. Then you have to allow him to eat grapes. One of the rules is that you can only eat from the same type of produce that you're working on. Therefore, the Mishnah says, if a person is working, for example, picking klufsin, yesterday had mentioned blusfin, if you heard they ate them, if Shimon didn't eat them, or whatever, some kind of indigestible figs, these klufsin over here may be the same. Some type of figs, actually, not yet. So Hoya Osiv Klufsim Lo Yechob of Nois Sheva, then you're not allowed to eat from Bnois Sheva, because those are two different types of figs. But Bnois Sheva Lo Yechob of Klufsim. They're different types, and therefore if you're working with Klufsim, you can eat Klufsim, but you can't eat Bnois Sheva. Okay, my Klufsim, what are Klufsim? Minit the Taini to Abdim in Hoylakti. These are a type of figs that are used to make, that are used to make various kinds of food out of. In other words, there's figs that you would actually eat raw. And then there's kinds of figs, I guess, of lower quality or whatever, that you'd use to make, you'd cook them and make porridge or other kinds of foods out of them. In Bava Metzia, actually, it uses the word lafti as a kind of food that was fed to sick people. It mentions over there by Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Shimon, who was sick for many years, and people brought him lafti. So it could be same kind of thing over here. It may mean like some kind of soft food that you'd give to sick people. So the Gemara tells, Havu Gavra Diyoyb Avda Lachavre Lachmuri Alpha Mini Lachti. There was a person who gave his friend a slave with the deal that the slave would teach him, or that he'd teach the slave, whatever, a thousand different kinds of lachti to make. In the end, Agmuri Tmani Meya, in the end, he only taught him 800. Asmuri the Dinah, Kameh the Rebbe. So he took him to a din Torah in front of Rebbe. Omer Rebbe, So Rebbe says, you know what? You're talking 800 or 1,000 different kinds of lati. You should know something. Our forefathers said we've forgotten good. It's a pasuk in Echa. We had all the good, and now with Golos we've forgotten it. We haven't even seen that kind of good with our own eyes. In other words, like Rebbe is saying, you're upset that the guy only taught you 800 ways. That even 800 ways is quite a huge thing that we don't even know of such things nowadays. So I saw an explanation, deeper explanation behind this is the 1,000 kinds of food represents that these are two tzaddikim, two Bali Kabbalah. One of them wants the other one to teach him 1,000 different yichudim, 1,000 different kavanas in Kabbalah. The guy only teaches him 800 because that's all he knows. So Rebbe says that there's an association with there's a Gemara I think in Moed Cotton that mentions that David HaMelech, when he was fighting against his enemies, against the Goyim who were always harassing the Jewish people, he would be able to kill 800 of the enemy at a time. But he was upset. The Torah says Echa Yudif Echad Elef, that you should be able to kill 1,000. And the Baskel comes and says, you know what, you lost that Rak Midvar Uriah Achiti because of the Avera with Bathsheba and Uriah, therefore you lost 200 out of 1,000. But now, when this didn't Torah to come to Rebbe, how you talking? You didn't teach me all the 1,000 Yechudim. So Rebbe says, you know what? I mean, look, I mean, our ancestors, even David HaMelech, only knew 800, and you're upset that you don't know 1,000? We'll continue tomorrow, Beth Hashem. A very, very funny story tomorrow about Rebbe and Bar Kapara.